But tonight I'm happy to have Rob Schmidt speaking here. Rob Schmidt is one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea.
You can hardly stop Rob Schmidt from speaking here. It's a difficult challenge.
And he has been a teacher, a meditation teacher at the Tellu Meditation Center for decades, I think.
Decades. So,
and tonight he will be speaking Dangerous Meditation, the Esoteric Pearl of Great Price. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Actually, now that you mention it, since you mentioned decades, that caused me to reflect that actually quarter of a century as a Tellu teacher. So what has esotericism done for me? maybe we'll get some kind of gleaning of what that might mean as the evening goes on. But welcome, glad to see you, and the stalwart adventurers into the esoteric frontiers of Sebastopol tonight. The esoteric, the idea of the esoteric, is something that both attracts and repels people, I think, in a lot of ways. It both attracts people because everyone wants to know the secret or the secrets. You know, that's inherently attractive. And we want to know secrets that other people don't know, which makes it even better, of course. That's a natural impulse of our primate heritage. We want to... sorry, I had to throw some anthropology in there right away. That's where my academic training was in anthropology. So I tend to throw that in from time to time because it's ready to hand. But it's true. That's the reason that secrets, or one of the main reasons that secrets are appealing, is because we know, or we think we know something that other people don't know. So that's one thing about secrets. The secrets of esotericism. But the other point, of course, is that there are no secrets anymore. As I said wrote in the write-up to describe this talk, or at least the internet, the publishing industry, blogs, my blog for that matter, through this store website, all conspire to reveal the secrets of spiritual work in ways that could not have happened 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000, 2,000 years ago. Just a few minutes before we began here, I was speaking with someone in the audience, and we were talking about the Eleusinian Mysteries, one of the earliest esoteric rites or groups, both, I guess, from ancient Greece. And it's, to this day, it is the, to my knowledge, it's one of those rare examples where thousands of people were initiated into the Eleusinian Mysteries over centuries. It would have been tens of thousands easily, maybe hundreds of thousands, or even more, I don't know. Many people were initiated into the Eleusinian Mysteries, an esoteric rite in Greece that had happened well before Christ, centuries before Christ, and was happening after Christ. And somehow, nobody let the cat out of the bag. Nobody wrote it down. None of the people initiated actually broke the secret and recorded it for non-initiated people to have access to. Well, that ain't happening much today, as we all know. There's a lot of stuff out there, and far more stuff than you could ever possibly read in a lifetime, unless maybe you had the wealth of Bill Gates and no demands on your time. I suppose then you might have a chance to start to read all that stuff. But what would be the point anyway. Last week we had a fantastic talk here in the store by a fellow named R.J. Stewart, who is actually a teacher in an esoteric European tradition. And he made the point, he was talking about his book, The Miracle Tree, available here for sale at Many Rivers, an excellent book, which describes Western Kabbalah, one of the best known Western esoteric traditions. And probably the principal point that he made in his talk was that almost everything that's written about Western Kabbalah is nonsense designed to confuse and complicate a very simple basic practice or set of practices. And his point further was that in the 19th century all this gobbledygook, all these gobbledygooky texts started to be written after the oral tradition began to be written down. I'm simplifying here a little bit, but this is the basic point that he was making. And so that process of writing down secrets has a lot of consequences. We can't get into all of them tonight. But several of those consequences are relevant to what I want to talk about, which is dangerous meditation and what that might mean and why there might be a link to so-called esotericism. One of the reasons that that people wouldn't come to a talk like this is precisely that there is an association now, because of the sort of thing that Stewart was talking about last week, this writing down of arcane unnecessarily and even obfuscatory, I'm sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but obfuscatory texts designed to mislead people or misdirect people to think that all you had to do was apply your discursive mind to understand reality and to understand esoteric secrets, when of course nothing could be further from the truth. So dangerous meditation fits in here, because actually these simple truths are in fact dangerous. It's the obfuscatory, complicated, arcane stuff that surrounds esotericism that not only puts people off, and in many cases was designed to put people off, that's one of the points that Stewart was making as well, but also misdirects the people who have a surface interest, a surface curiosity in esotericism only. So that's the point I want to make first, and stress here first, is that dangerous meditation is exactly what its billing would suggest. Dangerous meditation is just that form of meditation which makes continuing to live your life as you have been used to living it untenable on the previous terms that you lived it, if you consistently apply the dangerous meditation techniques that real esoteric traditions, that real spiritual traditions, that real religious traditions have on offer. And there are lots of ways that happens. We'll start to talk about some of them in a minute. But first, I want to make sure that any questions so far, is that this is all fair. This should all be fairly straightforward, I think, what I've been going over. But if there's any questions, comments, Let me open the floor before I delve into a new direction here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just about the dangerous aspect. Is mm-hmm. it possible that there's a second agenda in the misdirection, and that is to throw perhaps the ecclesiastical authorities off the trail?
As you of course have hit on an important feature of the way esoteric, real esoteric spiritual traditions have in fact disguised themselves from not just ecclesiastical authorities, but from any power possessing beings mm-hmm. who might be inclined to disapprove of and create trouble for, mildly or severely, for the operations of such an enterprise. So yeah, that is for sure the case. I don't think it was the motivation in the 19th century, for example, when Stuart is pointing out that for Kabbalah and Western a lot of other related sort of traditions, you get really long-winded writing that, as Stuart put it musingly, is practically unreadable nowadays. It's really hard to read some of these Victorian texts about spiritual and religious subjects now, because it's so full of stuff that's really hard to get. So I don't think that was. There might have been a little bit of that there, because England and Europe in general and North America were coming out of course, a very repressive religious regimes, a history of those. But I think there were other factors as well. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think that's a very important point. Thank you.
I was thinking all the way back to the Inquisition and wondering if that happened to be an effect.
Well, the example that comes, I'm sure that's certainly part of it. I mean, we know that the Maranos, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, the Spanish Jews who were forced to either go into exile or convert to Catholicism, if they wanted to maintain some of their own traditions, had to do so in extraordinary secrecy, and such secrecy that it was even very difficult to pass on stuff about the Jewish tradition from generation to generation. So a lot of that stuff became very convoluted. But the other example that came to mind for me was Sufism, where much of Sufism is much of the outer trappings of Sufi schools was explicitly designed to protect the initiates from being persecuted or worse by the civil and religious authorities. There wasn't really a distinction there in those regimes. So yeah, there have been many reasons, and some of them quite compelling reasons to hide truths. In the case of the Eleusinian Mysteries, we're talking about 2,500 years ago or more. I don't think that was there were other things going on there. So it's there have been waves, and things proceed differently in different circumstances at different times. But I guess I'm suggesting as a starting point that we consider the possibility that this time and this place is unique in human history in the way that so-called esoteric, so-called spiritual secrets are framed, need to be framed, etc. Make sense?
It just came up for me was the risk of the moment and living without agenda,
mm-hmm.
Releasing the agendas that were carrying us along before, because the moment has its own agenda,
mm-hmm.
and so releasing the preset notions and preset ideas means we're suddenly faced with the enormity of the moment.
That's an extremely important point. And in fact, I think, you know, in one sense you have in words summarized the obstacle to all spiritual practice. If we could admit the full or even a much fuller appreciation of and openness to everything that's happening right now, right here, in this room and through the connections of everyone and everything in this room to everything else in the universe, if we could fully see and appreciate that, it would, as the 60s phrase has it, blow your mind. And in fact, that is the purpose of an esoteric and spiritual school. No, it's not to blow your mind. It's to expand your mind so that it does not have to get blown up, so that eventually it can get bigger than it would ever have gotten through taking drugs or through trance dancing or through whatever methodology you might...
Reading every spiritual book there is.
Reading every spiritual book there is, whatever methodology you might choose. It's a way to expand your mind such that it could be far bigger than you could ever imagine, than you could ever have imagined. Okay. Ever have imagined what that could be.
There's only one mind.
Sure. That's certainly one way to look at it, and I don't have a problem with it. But to really know that there is only one mind, that there is only one mind that suffuses this body, these bodies, these things, these emotional reactivities that we're used to identifying with, these ideas and idea structures and habits of referring to and reifying ideas, all that stuff is the bars of the prisons that we keep ourselves in to keep ourselves safe, not from anything other than that vast reality. So, but this organism sitting here in front of you, that organism sitting in the chair under your ass, that too is a fullness that is vaster than anything that our discursive minds could ever hope to grasp. So that is, in fact, you're right, that is, in fact, what grasping is the issue.
You mean conceptually?
I mean being bigger than that thing. I don't mean that it's the goal to grasp, because that is an act that always ends up being elusive and pointless. But I am saying that consciousness, not the mind, but consciousness and awareness can be greater than these things that we're used to reifying. Okay? And that is, in fact, the goal of spiritual practice. And that is dangerous, because when you actually go there, it ain't as safe as we've set it up to be here, with the rules and regulations, the ethical guidelines and precepts, the laws of physics, the laws of biology, etc., etc. I'm not saying that those don't exist in those places, by the way, but I'm not saying either that consciousness is bound by that. So that's So it gets very tricky as soon as you start using words to describe this stuff. So I want to suggest, before we go on, a little experiment here. If you can, put your feet, if your not feet are not already on the floor, why don't you put your feet on the floor and simply look down at them for a second and sort of get in touch with them and put your attention on them from the inside so that you can feel what your feet feel like. These fragments of this organism that you call you, or I call you anyway, for convenience sake, if nothing else. And feel that pressure of your shoes on the feet. Feel the weight of gravity pulling your feet onto the floor. Feel anything that's going on in those extensions of the body. Okay. So now looking down and on those feet, now maintaining your inner awareness on your feet, bring your eyes up, back up here to be with me. Now maintain that awareness on your feet as I'm talking. What I want you to do to continue this exercise is to try to put enough attention on your feet that as I continue to speak, your discursive mind doesn't engage in the way you're used to having it do. What do I mean by that? Keep your attention on your feet. What do I mean by that? I mean that normally, as you listen to someone speak, there is a way in which your mind categorizes, rejects, accepts, pigeonholes, critiques, applauds, any and all of the above. It does this feature by which, keep your attention on your feet here, not your eyes. You can keep your eyes up here with me. Keep your attention on your feet. There is a function, a customary function, by which we, our attention, our energy, tends to go up to the noggin. And I'm asking you, as an exercise, to experiment with keeping your attention down in your feet instead, and listening to what I say. So listen from that perspective in such a way that the attention you usually give to the function of mind that picks and chooses what you hear, less energy. Okay? My teacher used to describe this exercise in the following terms. He used to encourage people when they go to a spiritual talk to listen to the teacher and turn off your mind. That's hard to do. Instead, I'm suggesting, especially if you don't have training. If you do have training, then it can be done. Not a problem. But if you don't have that training, then use these feet to try to redirect your energy away from this usual functioning. Okay? Why do I want you to do that? Well, that's because what that usual functioning is about is reifying fragmentary consciousness. What happens in our heads is that we do this thing called identification, and we identify with different parts of this constellation that we call me. We identify with each of those parts. So at one moment there will be a voice in my head saying, what a fool that guy is. Does he really think I can sit here for 5 minutes even putting my attention on my feet? Or, I can do this with my eyes closed or open. I'll show him, the asshole. Or, you know, various different voices that might come up. Okay? We identify with those voices. Those are fragmentary parts of consciousness. And whether you know it or not, most of the time, you've got multiple voices chattering away in there. Usually we're only aware of one at a time, the one we choose to identify with. But when we take the time to look, and that's what dangerous meditation starts with, really, when we take the time to look, we begin to see that, in fact, oh my God, it's I was going to say a party, but maybe party isn't the right way to describe it. It's a I don't know. It's it's a jailhouse, you know, full of inmates, and they're all in their individual cells, and they're all yammering at each other. And some of them, one particular inmate doesn't like that inmate, and the other one wants to get in the cell with that inmate, and the other ones, you know, are on this. Some of them form a team, and this is another team. It's all a big clamorous mess, really. But attention on your feet, right? So attention on your feet helps you to take a little of that energy away from reification of the process of fragmentation of your consciousness. Now, why do I bring that up? There's many reasons, but one is that, well, that's what an awful lot of esoteric spiritual traditions say is the direction to take spiritual practice, is to unify all the fragmentation. What's the point of that? We are told that the point of that is to be able to act with integrity, authority, and power. What does that mean? Integrity, of course, means simply the opposite of fragmentation. Authority means that we're speaking with one voice, that the energies that are usually dispersed and competing for that attention of identification. One voice wants to be in charge. And its promise always is, you put me in charge and I'll fix it all. I'll take care of everything. Happiness will blossom. You know, the birds will sing. The trees will bear fruit in the winter. 72 virgins will give you every possible desire you could wish. That's what the voices promise. But since they all promise that, those promises, we have reason to suspect whether there's actually something behind those promises. And that's what esoteric practice, dangerous meditation, is meant to reveal. It is meant to systematically uncover the truth of what's actually going on. Now, you don't know that this description I just offered is true unless you've done some self-examination meditation, some dangerous meditation yourselves. But to the extent that you have, you may be able to confirm this. Even if you haven't, you may still be able to have experience with the cacophony of voices competing for attention. The insistence by one that its hegemony is the most crucial thing that you could possibly support. But none of them have the secret. That's in one sense, the esoteric secret. none of these fragmentary parts of me can make me whole. I'll repeat that. None of these fragmentary parts of me can make me whole. That's what psychology is meant to do. That's what virtually every known methodology for bringing happiness, except for spiritual practice, is meant to do. It's meant to identify with the right one, the one that understands the way it really is, and then proceed from there, fully giving yourself to that inner God. Yes.
So you're talking about shifting the point of reference, away from that perspective which fragments.
Yes, and which is itself, of course, fragmented as well. It's a hall of mirrors we're talking about.
If we're shifting it, because that's one of the things I do when I do the hand gestures, is I'm actually shifting the point of reference.
Okay.
And it's tremendously helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's always helpful for me. Just one quick thought, something I wrote a long time ago that you just reminded me of, is that the universe is a detective story,
mm-hmm.
and God is the Watson to quicken the Holmes in us.
Okay, that's cute. but I'm going to suggest for your consideration that what I'm talking about is not just a shift in perspective, okay? It's because when we talk about a shift in perspective, I'm suggesting that it is almost inevitable that what that means is our mind will interpret, oh, I have to get my mind identified with the right program as opposed to the wrong program.
With no program.
Okay, I got that.
Okay.
But that, too, will be interpreted by the mind as a program. Okay, and that's therein lies the difficulty. Exactly right. The challenge is, where do you seek a foundation from which and with which to proceed in this situation, which, if you admit the reality of it, is totally fucked. Ooh. I guess that's going to go on the web. It's totally screwed by... thank you very much. By the way that our minds work. The way that our organisms work. It's not just the mind. The mind is located through the whole body, and vice versa. The emotions are reverberations between those two, in one sense, the usual emotions that we're talking about, not what in some esoteric circles might be called higher functions of higher mind or higher emotions. But we're not ready to talk about that yet. For now, we're in this situation where, you know, Mother Megillah, what do I do? Where do I go? To whom do I turn? Dangerous meditation is dangerous because it reveals, if we are really honest with ourselves, it reveals what Gurdjieff called the terror of the situation. The terror of the situation is that all the ordinary tools to make ourselves happy, to distract ourselves from seeing reality, are at best distractions from seeing reality. And that eventually we can't put off paying the bill of seeing reality. And that bill comes due, if not earlier, at death, when there is no more usual functioning of mind, etc., to disguise the reality that I'm referring to here, to disguise the truth of how the universe is actually constructed. And that is dangerous, extremely dangerous, to the safe, secure, egoic identities that we have invested most of our energies in establishing and maintaining. These egoic identities don't want to know this stuff. They've been told, if you follow the rules, if you do what you're told, if you identify with this idea, with this great cause, with this conception of how to live your life, then everything will be okay. And what I'm suggesting to you is that dangerous meditation is the most dangerous thing there is. It's more dangerous than, in one sense, dangers to our physical bodies, because if you accept the idea that there is a return of habit energies, so that you can't just kill your body off and get out of the whole wheel that way. If you accept that idea, then this all makes sense. If you don't accept that idea, it can still make sense, but I have to. Then I'd have to approach it from a different perspective.
Who was the woman who had the stroke, and she wrote about the experience on the stroke of?
Oh, you mean a woman who she published a book quite recently about this?
Bolt. Yeah. Okay.
I don't remember the name, but I heard an interview with her actually.
Yeah, she was describing this. This is what she was going through while she was having her stroke.
There are a lot of descriptions of approaching death, and the dissolution, the beginning stages, just the first taste of the dissolution of the habit energies that we maintain, to make these to give ourselves the illusion that these organisms are solid, stable, and safe and secure, and will take us where we want to go, darn it. But when, as soon as we start to see what they're really composed of, which is just fluxing energy, then it's freak-out time for most of us. The reason to do spiritual practice from one perspective, from this perspective I'm articulating right now, is precisely so that we can handle those energies no matter what happens and where we are, which of course would include the end of this body, the end of this mind, the contact, as you put it earlier, with the one mind. The one mind is the refuge, but for this organism with its habits of attachment, what it feels like to approach that mind without aid or assistance is excruciating, because all this egoic mind knows is clinging. And clinging is what will be ripped asunder gently or with as much force as necessary eventually, if all the great spiritual traditions of the world are to be believed. So, That means, second, that means that we'd better get ready. And the reason to do so-called esoteric practice, the reason to do dangerous meditation, is precisely to be able to handle anything. If we start to do it ourselves deliberately and intentionally, hi, come on in, then that changes how things work. We had a question over here.
Yeah, I'd like to know what you're thinking of and what's going on when you say handle.
Good question. That was a word that I take from my own teacher. And handle, essentially, as I'm using the term here, in other words, handle the habit of clinging to the illusion of an egoic identity, means essentially to very slowly and mostly quite gently tease its constituent parts apart in such a way that I actually could reassemble them, take them apart again, reassemble them, assemble them in a different fashion, etc., as opposed to having the perspective of not being able to handle it, which is sometimes called insanity, sometimes called nightmares, sometimes called a psychotic episode, you know, blah, blah, blah. So does that clarify?
Somewhat.
Okay.
It's like a kind of balance. Something you said earlier is to be able to handle it when the identity is blown or ripped apart.
Yeah.
So, and then when you say not handle it would be a psychotic episode or...
Oh, okay. Let me...
There's a balance.
Let me clarify further then. What I mean to say is that it is possible to learn how to view, to put attention on the constituent elements of consciousness, of so-called beingness, in such a way that as those things move around, which they are always doing anyway. It's an illusion that they're ever stable. But, that aside, one wants to be able to put full attention on the process, no matter what rate the process is happening, no matter the scale or intensity that the process is occurring, such that one doesn't have to get freaked out by the reality that everything we think we can hold on to is completely fluid and has no stability in the way that our minds and bodies and hearts think they have. There is refuge. There is stability. It's just that we're looking in the wrong places for it. That's the key. That's the esoteric direction here. And the mistake, from my perspective, is to decide that, oh, I can put this off and I can pretend it won't affect me. It's kind of like the U.S., you know, financial community recently with subprime mortgages. You know, I can put this off and it's not going to affect me. We see how well that has worked now. Well, that's the situation with the constituent elements of our own consciousness. The fact that I can tell you that you are held in loving regard by the mind that is eternal and always abides is irrelevant when your habit is to identify with a fragment that is itself constantly changing, that's whose relationship with other fragments of this figment of an of our imaginations that we call a being of integrity, these things just don't cohere in the way that we have been taught they cohere. And that's the esoteric secret. Yeah. Oh, does that answer the question better? Mm-hmm. Good.
What do you constituent elements of consciousness look like?
You're looking at them right now, so you tell me.
Well, I got that.
What about your feet? What about them? You still looking at them?
Sort of.
Okay. Well, remember them now. Go back to them now. And what can you tell me about those?
My feet are a little cold right now, but they're there.
Okay.
I can also feel my legs and my butt on the chair and mm-hmm. some other stuff.
Good.
And as you're talking, I see kind of reactions arising, you know, like, oh, I got a good question that I'm going to ask, or something happening in there.
Well, those are.
Or if I like something you say.
Right. Those are constituent elements. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's nothing remarkable. For most people, what that'll mean is the little voices in our heads. Oh, I liked that. Oh, I didn't like that. Oh, that's crap. Oh, that's inspired genius. You know?
There's a feeling that comes even if my mind says inspired genius.
Yes, exactly right. That's the reverberations, the emotional, what I referred to earlier, is, you know, in the mind-body complex, that sort of phenomenon that you just mentioned is a reverberation through the organism, which we interpret as an emotion. And that's part of the mix, for sure. In fact, there's nothing you're not aware of now. Probably. Maybe, I don't know. But mostly, there's nothing you're not aware of now that is not part of the constituent elements of your consciousness. How could it be? So the awareness of other bodies, human bodies, and other mammals, other primates in this room, that has so many unstated ramifications in your consciousness that we normally do not look at. We are, you know, social mammals, primates in particular. That means we have all kinds of habits of how we both interact with these other bodies, but also how we fabricate the illusion of an identity for this one based on their actions in and around this organism. So it's that's all part of it. That's all part of it. And it's our habit of attachment to these things, our habit of identification with these things, that screws things up. Screws things up in the sense that instead of having a relationship of liberation with respect to these aspects of consciousness, we have a relationship of slavery. When we give our habit energy the boost of identification through attachment, then we're ensnared in jail, you know, put in jail. We put ourselves in jail, and we pretend to throw away the key. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Rob, you use the word dangerous. It seems to me that being enslaved to attachment sounds pretty dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Dangerous,
I agree.
Right. But to me, dangerous sort of implies potential damage or harm.
Yes.
And I can see how, excuse my ignorance, but I can see how meditative process could be painful, difficult,
mm-hmm.
but dangerous, damaging?
Yes. And I'm talking about, I'll mention, I can't give details, but I know of people who have literally been killed and have killed themselves.
Goodness.
As a result of mishandling these processes, handling them irresponsibly. Okay. So yeah, I'd call that dangerous by any standards. Because even if you go with, well, you lose this body and you get another one, right? Nevertheless, you are taking along a big karmic burden, presumably, if you've made a big boo-boo like that to the next body. And that's going to make the liberation of that body even more difficult. So no matter how you look at it, yeah, it can be dangerous.
Dangerous no matter what you choose.
That is exactly the point. And so, my attitude is then, my gosh, if it's going to be this dangerous, I'd better look where I'm going. I'd better pay attention to what I'm doing. And that is the least dangerous thing. People kill themselves through attachment as well, in the ordinary sense, all the time. Attachment to drugs, attachment to unsafe behavior of a thousand different forms. You know, that's built in. And I'm not suggesting that there is some kind of safety for these organisms and the attachments that we're used to clinging to. I am suggesting that there is, or maybe, this is for all your consideration here, I am suggesting that there is something in you that is senior to that body and those habits. And that's true for all of us, of course. And that if that's true, then, my gosh, I want to know what the heck I'm doing. And it's true that there's no safety. But, you know, the pain you talked about and dismissed so blithely.
Oh, I don't know. I think I was blind.
Okay, good. All right, fair enough. But the pain that we can encounter from actually looking at the habit energies that we've got going is usually the thing that sends people running to the hills, as far away from esoteric practice, as far away from dangerous meditation, as far into distractive habits as they can possibly get. You know? So that's tough. Thank you.
Thank you.
It takes strength. It takes strength to be able to speak the truth, to say the truth.
Okay. Is that a statement or a question?
Well, what I was going at is that if there weren't danger, then danger means that risk is involved. Mm-hmm. And risk means you're going to be trying the limits. Mm-hmm. You're going to be trying yourself.
Yes.
And that's where the strength is learned. And eventually, that's where strength comes. And eventually, with that strength comes the ability to speak the truth, to live the truth. So, I'm just looking at the relationship between danger and risk,
mm-hmm.
and that if it doesn't involve risk, then
what's the point?
What's the point? Yeah, and this comes back to the issue of secrets, mm-hmm. too, because there is that in us that wants to, that's illuminated by is it right to say knowing the secrets? So there is an experience that comes with that which is unlike any other experience, and once you've had it, I wouldn't call it addictive, but it calls you as the beloved calls you. But I was just looking at risk and danger.
Okay.
And
well, let me just comment on the last thing that you said first, which is this attraction to secret truth. That's not quite how you said it.
I'm not sure about what it is that I was trying to say.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. But let me tell you what came up for me when you said it, which was I was listening on the radio yesterday in the car to a woman describing how she ended up becoming a scientist. She started off as, like, I don't know, in 11 or 12, she was in her room, and by playing with a basket full of eggs, she was able to figure out the truth of centrifugal force. That if you cause something, a container, to whirl around, even when it's upside down, the contents are not pulled by gravity out of the container. And so she discovered this. It was this huge revelation for her, and she wanted more of that. So she goes off to college, and her first physics lecture is some guy, I can't remember if it was MIT or whatever. You know, it's some guy who's famous for doing this lecture where he takes a container of water and does exactly the same thing, and the water doesn't come out. If you're applying this rotational energy, this circular energy to it, so she discovered an esoteric truth, in a sense, on her own. When the guy doing this interview said, "So did you consider that? Did you feel let down because here's this professor doing this thing that you had figured out by yourself?" And her answer was no, because I figured it out myself. I did not simply receive it through authority. And that's the thing about doing real spiritual practice. There are, as we've said already, 1,000 descriptions of how consciousness works. 1,000 descriptions of how the interactions between body and mind work. 1,000 proposals for how the relationship of this organism to forces greater than it can lead to non-attachment, to bliss, to refuge, to safety. Okay? But we have to find it out ourselves. And I'm going to twist now the word secret, because the way we do that is to expose those dirty little secrets about our attachments, the attachments of this organism to its various habit energies, such that we learn the process like the little girl did, the young woman did. That's what spiritual practitioners do. We learn how to first appreciate the principle that the illumination of truth is incredible. Nothing like it. One can treat the exterior of it like an addiction, but the interior of it is, by its nature, free and clean.
Liberation.
And beautiful. Yes, it's liberation. That's
now
liberation.
The truth in it will set you free.
Right. But it's easy to say that when you have, as we tend to have, the enormous karmic habit energies that may well extend way back, however far back you want to describe that. It takes an awful lot to be able to accomplish this revelation, secret by secret. So we can start with, damn, it's hard to keep my attention on my feet for an hour. Not much of a secret there, but depending on how hard, how strongly you set the intention, you can see a truth in this. Was the whole of you participating? Sorry, sir, you missed this exercise that we did earlier on. So,
I'm checking in my feet.
Yeah.
I'm catching up as fast as I can.
Okay. The idea was that we would put attention on our feet instead of our heads, so that we could actually listen to what is being said here tonight without sending it through the usual sensors that we have going on in consciousness to categorize it, to decide whether it's good or bad, how good, how bad, etc. So this process of going through the secrets that each little fragment has and considers to be absolutely crucial to maintain. Each little fragment doesn't want to give up its secret. Sometimes the secret is very easy to give up because the fragment doesn't have a lot of energy associated with it. And sometimes, in other cases, those fragments have so much energy that we are scared. What's a synonym for shitless? What's that? Scared to death. Very good. That we are scared to death of looking at those secrets. Sometimes, to really reveal a secret, we have to actually. Isn't this fun? I mean, this thing is this little microphone is like a it's a great reminder.
Not to swear.
Not to what?
Not to swear.
No. It's a great reminder to maintain attention on what we're doing. I could give a flying fuck about swearing. And I'd be happy to do that if my arms would fly me around the room. But no, I'm not held back by that consideration. But it's fun to pretend as if I am, because it reminds you guys, and hopefully any listener, who downloads this MP3 file in the future, that all this stuff is just phenomena. That's all it is. And all our clingy attachments, all our, oh my God, I can never tell anyone this, I can never reveal this secret, is just really a not very interesting illusion. I just had to write a very long email to someone today who couldn't even talk to me about a certain thing in person. He had to write me a long email because he couldn't bring himself to have a more personal revelation of the secret. Now, you know, as secrets go, this was a pretty good one, you know, by most standards. But to me, it was like, give me a break. This is nothing. This is not a big deal. We only make it a big deal because we treat it like a big deal. Now, there are many ramifications of how we do that, and that's why I had to talk earlier about teasing these things apart slowly, one by one. It's like untying, unraveling the Gordian knot. That is, you know, one metaphor to describe this process. I'm not, you know, a big proponent of what in Zen circles used to be called, or probably still is, called sudden enlightenment. Not to say that there are not brilliant flashes of illumination that occur. Of course there are. And are they fun? You betcha. Said Sarah Palin. No. no, it's something else, though, to be absolutely systematic and methodical in treating the contents of consciousness as you would treat, I don't know, a puzzle in the Sunday paper that you enjoy solving. That's fun, right? There's a book on the shelves in this store called The Master Game by a guy named Robert Drop, former Sonoma County resident, now deceased.
That goes back to that's 40 years old.
That book is 40 years old, that's right. I'm an old fart, too.
I read that book first
now. My teacher was a big proponent of it. Mm-hmm. But the point is, The Master Game, for him, is just this process we're talking about here. It is teasing apart the contents of consciousness piece by piece, one after the other. Now, you are going to get surprised in that process, inevitably, because one fragment of consciousness doesn't have a clue what's going on with the other fragments, really. And so that's a big problem, apparently. But with persistence, then these things can be solved and addressed. They're not beyond our capacities. They're not. You created this. Some you created this. I wouldn't say a unitary you created this, because then you wouldn't be in the situation you're in. But responsibility can't be shared so easily or delegated very easily in this regard. Maybe a better word for it, delegated. So that is part of the point, though. It is fun if you decide that it can be fun. Not always fun. There will be those moments when it feels like you're treading through quicksand that's, you know, pulling you in. But if you refuse to be, if you refuse to believe that the obstacles will stop you, it's amazing what you can accomplish. That's a proposition for you to test. I wouldn't want you to take anything I've said tonight simply because I said it. That is yet another, that habit of attachment is yet another obstacle that is one of the worst habits for extending karmic energy, for weighing us down, for preventing us from doing interesting things that you could possibly imagine. So test for yourself. That's the only thing that works. Like the young woman with the eggs in the basket. You have lots of eggs in each of your baskets, but if you treat those baskets the right way, the eggs won't fall out and break. I don't know how I can extend that metaphor further. It's not coming right now. Yeah.
Having not been here at the beginning, I'm a little concerned to ask this question, but the pearl of great wisdom comes at a great price.
Yes.
The price that... what is the price that we're paying? And does that tie into these questions of dangerousness and fear?
Yes.
Pay attention.
It absolutely does. So, in fact, we haven't talked about the pearl yet. So you've been the first one to bring it up, and I'm glad you did, because it's one of my favorite metaphors for this goal of liberation. You know, in the Bible, of course, the pearl is something that the merchant has to spend everything that he has to acquire. And that aspect of the metaphor is the precisely relevant one here. We have to be willing to examine every aspect of our constituent parts. As we were talking about before, you may have missed that part, I don't know.
Dirty little secrets. That's
part of, yes, definitely the dirty little secrets and the tedious things that who wants to bother looking at, you know, oh my God, my mind knows this well. None of the rest, you know, the rest of me knows, or one fragment of consciousness knows this oh so well, thinks it does, asserts that it does. But the fact is, there has to be coordination. There has to be, to create integrity, we have to use methods that will actually create that. And those methods mean paying attention in a way different than we are used to doing. And so that means we have to slog through stuff we think we know, or one part of us thinks we know, and that's part of the price as well. So the price is at times terrifying from the fear of revealing something that we do not wish to see or do not wish to reveal to others. Sometimes it is excruciating in its tedium until we make the breakthrough. Every time there's a breakthrough, you know, there's a release of energy. It feels good. And that's a little carrot, you know, that the process seems to have built into it, which is nice. But the key is the creation of persistence, and it's the creation of persistence is not something that you can do overnight. It's a demonstration to yourself, in fact, of what's the most important thing to you in your life. What we're talking about doing does not impede doing anything else, necessarily. Any particular thing. That is to say, the attention I'm talking about can be directed at the constituents of consciousness in the midst of any activity. And in fact, ought to be. So we don't have to give up golf. We don't have to give up, coffee, tea. We don't have to give up any particular thing.
Especially tea.
Oh, definitely tea. In this store. We don't have to give up any particular thing, but we do have to be willing to look and be present impartially and without judgment at everything that arises in the field of consciousness. And that is indeed a heavy price. Or the ordinary habits of mind interpret it as a heavy price. Actually, when the habit becomes established and stabilized and begins to really grow and take on an inertia of its own, then in fact, it feels great because it is an expansion of consciousness, which is something you missed earlier. We were talking about blowing your mind. Well, it's a way to blow your mind up gradually, blow your consciousness up gradually in a way that does not feel dangerous, that is more or less controlled. That's tough. It's a process that needs help. So, does that answer the question?
Yes. And you were going to get to the pearl of great wisdom.
Ah. So the pearl is nothing more than, well, there are different pearls. Maybe there's pearls within pearls. The pearl I was just describing is the pearl of stabilization of the process of self-examination at a place where that process will continue to the place where you and the pearl are no different. Where you and everything is no different. All phenomena. And so, and along the way, I could point to different descriptions of the pearl of great price, but we can only work on one at a time. You know, it doesn't work to try to. It just this. You know, with these Russian dolls, you have to work on the biggest one, the outer one, first, and then when that reveals itself and its contents, then you move to the next stage. Just sort of like a. And the reverse of how the pearl itself was created in layers of the oyster. Thank you. Well, any final questions, comments, observations? This has been a wider ranging discussion than I might have guessed, but that's good. I will also mention that in closing that we will be commencing a practice group related to this material starting in the new year on Tuesday evenings here in this space. Every Tuesday except the fourth Tuesday. Fourth Tuesdays are reserved for our Sutra Salon meetings. But starting on I believe it's the 4th, Tuesday, January 4th, this coming year. We will be starting a practice group to discuss this here at 7:30 in this space. And if you want more information about that, there will be some on our January calendar when that comes out, on our website when we get all that written and put on there, or you can ask me about it after the meeting.
So,
yes.
So,
with all this observation and everything, when kind of like when all the wheels fall off, and mm-hmm. the unraveling and whatever, it seems like there's got to be a method to sort of get through it, you know?
Absolutely. There are in fact several methods.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because next week, the continuation of this talk by Stuart Gudnick of Tayu Meditation Center will in fact discuss some of these techniques. Specifically, he'll be looking at one of them called co-meditation, which is a two-person meditation form where we put attention on another person quite explicitly in order to synchronize attention with the other in a productive fashion to learn more about ourselves. In addition to the co-meditation, of course, there's also the basic form of self-observation meditation, which is an impartial meditation format. That is a format whereby we establish an artifact of consciousness which observes all the elements of consciousness impartially, without commenting,
right.
judging, etc. So those are the basics, but then there's lots of other things we do in addition to those to move ahead. Because as you're exactly right to point out, that all this stuff is a big, you know, it's way too much to handle. And so a spiritual school, which is another way to describe the esotericism, the esoteric groups that we started off talking about, is designed precisely to produce just the conditions that will be most conducive, at least for people in our cultural context, to move ahead to do that. So you need help. As social mammals, we need help. We need people involved in the same project. The Buddha was explicit in saying again and again in the sutras that you need to be working with like-minded colleagues to move forward with this kind of project. Because our tendency is to get completely distracted by all these fragments of consciousness, which are very compelling and powerful. And dangerous.
A little confused.
Exactly. So thank you for bringing that up.
I like the word community. We need community. Help is kind of implicit in community.
Mm-hmm. Well, dharma is the in the Buddhist tradition. There's dharma and there's sangha, and sangha is the community, and every genuine esoteric group, every genuine spiritual group arises out of a form of community I will propose for your consideration. So our community uses certain methods. We don't claim to have the only methods that are useful, but we do claim to have methods that are productive and can be productive for people who apply them. At least as productive for people in our cultural matrix as you'll find in any.
It's like looking for the unifying principle, or for like the fragments are looking for something that will unify them with each. Until the unifying principle is there, then they are fragments. But when the unifying principle is introduced, then suddenly the fragments kind of start noticing each other and maybe doing a little dance.
I wish it were as nice as the way you make it sound. In my experience, it's not quite as sweet, but let's just say that the key thing which I'll leave you with is your discursive mind, your mind that speaks, is not the tool that can accomplish unity.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the hardest thing to embody, because we don't have familiarity with the other assets of consciousness that we either have available already or can fabricate within consciousness in order to accomplish this goal. So that's the tricky part, and that's the reason that we need this help and community. So with that, I will thank you all for joining us tonight, and I look forward to seeing you at next week's talk for those who are interested, and hopefully we can move forward with some of you in community to address these issues. Thank you.